This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Great to have you with us. Your chance to catch up on some of our favourite guests, the real life stories, and the listening public getting the answers that they need to a whole host of questions, plus looking behind the headlines. This week we were honouring Paul Dodds, the founder of Movement and Me, who suddenly passed away during a swim class. I was in conversation with Nadia Mankani, whose children were coached by Paul about how they will honour his memory. And we had so many messages from you all wanting to pay tribute to this amazing man. And have you ever heard of a fertility doula? Well, IVF is big business here in the UAE. So how about finding someone to help hold your hand and guide you through the process, making sure you're seeing the right doctor and hopefully not having to go through as many cycles as you fear? Cassie Tosino was talking about the benefits of having an IVF concierge, and her client, Ali Clifton, shared about her ordeal while going through it. And don't tell me how to parent. We have all been there. The uninvited advice of sometimes strangers, sometimes family members. Dr. Sarah Rasmi from Thrive Wellbeing Centre was on hand to tell us how to politely rebuff their advances. And many people, children, adults alike, complaining of issues around time management, procrastination, getting work done, getting homework done, and dealing, yes, of course, with distance learning. We were in conversation with Sarah Sankari from Dwight School Dubai, sharing her time management tips for children. And I spoke to two very smart teenagers about how their world needs to address unemployment during and after the pandemic.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Today we are honouring a man who made a huge difference, one that we really can't put into words, for many children's lives, many families' lives here in the UAE. Tragically, a regular guest on the show, Paul Dodd, the founder of Movement and Me, a group that encourages children to get active, to say that every girl can, felt unwell earlier last week during a swim class and suddenly passed away. Here is a clip of him when he was last on the show.
If you have a small number of people winning all the time, and the other 95% who aren't winning, that can be the drive for the ones who are winning and the very thing that turns other people away from physical activity. And as I say, what we is really the focus of, where we might have 5% who really excel and it is all about winning and they have that drive that that's what they want to do. There's the other 95% who might not be motivated by that and who are on the road to dropping out of physical activity, if not nurtured in a way to show that it's not just about that. It's about the enjoyment. It's the journey. It's about being able to participate and then do something that brings you a sense of feeling well.
So strange to hear his voice. And that's the kind of coach he was. It wasn't just about winning. It was making sure that every single child felt included and encouraged and wanted to move and exercise for the sheer joy of it. He wanted to teach children the value of trying, of getting active and having so much fun. I spoke earlier with Nadia Mankani, a Dubai mum of three whose children were coached by Paul, and he became really, really close to the family.
Paul and I were introduced through a common friend, Naomi. At the time, I was looking for a coach to help with my son's gross motor skills, with his balance and coordination. And Naomi said to me that he could help, but she also said that he was somebody that she wanted in her children's lives in any capacity. So I got in touch with Paul, and since then, for the last 3 years, he's come over twice a week, every single week. He'd come over for lessons, he'd bring his ukulele, he'd stay for dinner, he'd stay for a chat, and he could talk. He could always talk. And he would leave almost always without his shoes, sometimes without his phone, sometimes without his keys. He'd come back 5 minutes later, or sometimes he'd forget that he wasn't wearing shoes. And, you know, he became a very, very dear friend of the family. What he taught the kids is something that we as parents couldn't teach our kids. You know, he taught them to really come out of their comfort zone. You know, he taught them boundaries were only in their heads. He taught them this line that I hear them say all the time. Like, sometimes my son will be on a monkey bar and I'll hear him say, "My name is Samir and I can do it." And Paul would always start off lessons like that. He'd say, my name is Paul Dotty Dot, and I can do it. And I hear my son say it to himself under his breath when he finds things difficult. He was so supportive. My son went on this year to be diagnosed with dyspraxia. And, you know, that was a journey for us as a family. And he was on with us on that journey. He read every report, every assessment. He put things in perspective. He gave advice. He was with us through it all. And we are so, so grateful.
You sound so grateful that he came into your life in the first place and spent that time. And I think that comfort factor is so key in children, for them to find someone who is a safe person, an inspirational person outside of the family. And that actually doesn't happen that often.
He takes the time to get to know each child separately. You know, he knew exactly how to deal with all my children are so different from each other. He knew exactly how to deal with every one of them. He's, you know, like I was telling you, he's writing a book with my eldest, and it's called The Swimming Champions. It's characters that they came up with while they were swimming, like Joe Have a Go or Slow Mo, you know. And we'd like to finish that book. There's a chapter left to go. Thankfully, my son has the chapters that he wrote together with Paul, but we're looking for the plan and we're going to finish it with him. And we'd like to dedicate it to him. And, you know, we're going to make it a happy one.
Because that's exactly it. You know, your children will remember him forever. And they might not remember specific moments, but as you say, these mantras that they've been taught or size of the personalities that have been brought out, we've got no way of knowing what would have happened if he hadn't come into your lives. Mm-hmm. And to be able to honour him through that, because we know that his legacy is going to live on through people like you, through your kids and all of their potential that they're going to reach with everything that he was able to do for them.
Well, a lot of people said to us, like, are you going to tell your children? Because they're very young, you know, they're 7, 5 and 3. And they said to us, are you going to tell your children what happened? It was, you know, we only saw him last week. We saw him on Sunday. We spent the afternoon with him. We spoke to him on Monday. He sent them a voice note on Monday. And it's just too soon, I know. But, you know, they said to us, are you going to tell them? We don't want his legacy to be that he just disappeared from their lives. We will tell them because we will talk about him for decades to come, you know. We have his cat that we've adopted now. And, you know, hopefully they'll find comfort through her. And we want them to know what happened. So, yes, he's made a huge impact on their lives.
Such a shock from such a young, positive, healthy man who always had a smile, always had a kind word. You know, when I've had him in the studio before, just could have talked to him for hours. Felt like I could have learned so, so much from him. And it's a real loss. It's a real loss to people like you who knew him and when friends become family. And it's a real loss to Dubai for people that didn't get the chance to meet him and understand what he was about and get, you know, share some of his wisdom. And I'm so happy that he was a part of your family's life. And Nadia, thank you so much.
So it's just really nice to talk to people like you that have met him because, you know, he lit up every room he walked into. Like, you know, you've seen his infectious energy, his, you know, his enthusiasm, just his mad personality. And we feel really, really privileged to be a part of it. And I keep telling myself, you know, the candle that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And so here we are.
Nadia there, mum of three, whose family came to know Paul Dodd really well, the founder of Movement and Me, who sadly, suddenly passed away last week. We're paying tribute to Paul this afternoon. Let's hear now from his sister Wendy in the UK.
We wanted to thank Paul's Dubai family for their overwhelming support at this terribly sad time, and we wanted to extend our love and support to them. Paul moved to Dubai in 2014 to teach PE, and he was always energetic and enthusiastic at whatever he did, and he valued the benefit of movement and exercise. He taught swimming to so many children and adults, and his imagination was immense, and it always had to be fun. And we've received many testaments to the positive impact that he had on children and families that he worked with. Paul's journey in Dubai led him to set up Movement and Me, his business to promote understanding of physical literacy. Looking back at the messages he sent, they are all positive affirmations of words of encouragement and love and crazy ukulele songs. He was the best. He saw the best in everyone. He wanted everyone to have the best time. His wish was to return to the UK and continue his work here, but there'll always be a piece of his heart with his family and friends that he met in Dubai.
And that they will never forget Paul in this time. Sim's been in touch with us earlier, his flatmate, who said, "To this day, Paul's name is in my phone as Paul Sunshine. When I first met him, he was in a co-working space, was walking around barefoot, which I absolutely loved. He had this incredible radiance about him that just lit up the place. From that moment, that's all I knew him as, Sunshine. It's the same radiance that Paul took everywhere with him. Movement in me, every girl can, always wanting to make every situation fun and light and exciting. And that was one of Paul's mottos. If you're going to do anything, make sure you're excited about it. May his beautiful soul rest in peace. We love you, Paul." And Carrie, Paul's colleague from Movement and Me, got in touch saying he was all around such an amazing person. Every single person he came across, he left such a positive impact on them. And from Carrie, Megan, the Movement and Me team, a poem he loved. It's called "It Couldn't Be Done" by Edgar Allan Guest. "There are thousands to tell you it cannot be done. There are thousands to prophesize failure. There are thousands to point out to you one by one the dangers that wait to assail you. But just buckle in and with a bit of a grin, just take off your coat and go to it. Just start to sing as you tackle the thing that cannot be done, and you'll do it." So here he is again from the last time he was on the show. It's Paul Dodd from Movement and Me.
What we need to do collectively as coaches, teachers, parents, about giving the correct message to ensure that it's not just about winning. It's about the enjoyment of what physical activity brings. It's about the enjoyment that it provides us in terms of our self-esteem and our confidence. And that it shouldn't just be a case of needing to excel to be the very best.
Thank you to everyone who has been in touch this afternoon to honour Paul Dodd's life. As we said, an amazing man, a young, healthy, vibrant man, full of positivity, who it was just so infectious, such an absolute joy to be around, and his life tragically cut so short when he passed away last week. An incredible man, and I think we can all learn a serious lesson from him about physical literacy. It sounds complicated, doesn't it? It's really not. It's about having that positivity around our bodies, whatever size or shape or age, and doing what we can, feeling mindful and upbeat about what we can do. And as that poem said, you know, to hear the words, "it cannot be done," and just ignore them. With Sam saying, "I used to teach with Paul in the same school. Really saddened he passed away too soon. He was very positive. Would miss by all of his colleagues from the school. R.I.P. Paul." Masha saying, "Paul was such an inspiration to me. I admired all those wonderful qualities that made him the special person that he was. He had intelligence, wit, charm and a caring heart that made him a great friend." And Mariam called in to say this.
"He had so much of an impact on our son's life in so many positive ways. My son struggled with, hypermobility joints and, with confidence issues. And we weren't very sure if he would take up into swimming. And we told Paul all of that. And the way Paul took on to Musa, the way that he taught him and made him laugh, and he made everything so much fun. And it was more than a swimming lesson for us. It was more about integrating movement, agility, confidence, and just letting my son be free. I look at my son's weekend news and stories. They're all about him. We just want to let his family and all his friends know that, you know, there's so much of him that is going to live within our kids, with what we saw and what we learned. And if all of us could just be as kind as he was, the world would be so much of a better place."
Mariam, I couldn't agree more, and sending condolences to you and your family. What a privilege to know such an amazing man, and his legacy absolutely will live on, and the children that he worked with. Paul Dodd passing away last week, sadly and very, very suddenly indeed, and sending all of our condolences to everyone who met him.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Going through IVF, or even considering it, it's not just a medical procedure. It's invasive. It's emotional. It takes its toll on your mental health, your finances for sure. Your relationship makes you physically tired. And so much of that burden is on the woman. More often than not, they're looking for support outside of the four walls of the IVF clinic before they even get to the IVF clinic, from someone who has been there, can offer valuable advice. But until now, that hasn't been so easy. Well, Enter Cassie Tessino, who's the founder of IVF Support UAE and a fertility doula, a phrase I'd never heard of until recently. She's been through it, wants to offer a lending hand to women who are considering IVF or trying to navigate a world where there are so many experts, people sharing advice, pop-up ads for clinics. Cassie, thank you so much for coming on and explaining a little bit about how you can help couples here in the UAE. Why did you feel like this was necessary?
Well, hi, Helen. Hi. I'm really happy to be with you today. You know, I felt it was necessary because I went through it here, and I went through it as a very new expat. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know the landscape. I didn't know the clinics, and it was a lot of hard work, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And once I sort of got through the other side of it, I thought, I feel like I can make this easier for the next gal. So I started the group IVF Support UAE about 4 years ago, and then the more I learned about IVF, the more experience I had working with the clinics, the more I realized I could offer the members of the group. So I went and got training. There is a doula training course out of Canada that I spent several months doing, and now I have become a qualified fertility support practitioner, is the official word, and I'm here to just help smooth the path for other women so that they don't have to do it by themselves. They don't have to be alone. Someone can answer all of their questions and just make it a lot easier than it has been in the past.
And I think if anything here, there are so many clinics, there are so many doctors, and it can come down to personality, it can come down to finances, it can come down to the individual medical conditions of what a couple is going through. And trying to kind of cut through all of that noise at a time when people are already in an emotional place, it sounds like you're kind of holding their hand and being a bit of a concierge, for want of a better phrase. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. I like that. And yes, that is absolutely the case. But also, you know, another thing that I would like to be able to do is maybe help you avoid an IVF in the first place. There are lots of things that you can do to boost and support your fertility before you would even need to step foot in an IVF clinic. We can talk through those options. Mm-hmm. There are lots of other things that you can do. And then if it does come time to do some sort of assisted fertility, we can map that out. We can look at different clinics. We can look at different doctors. And I know all of these clinics now pretty well. I have a sense of who specializes in what. And also, as part of IVF Support UAE, I have organized free consultations for our members at many of the clinics. So I can just sort of hold your hand from here, hopefully, to parenthood.
Can I ask, as the founder of IVF Support UAE, what kind of role do these support groups have, especially during a pandemic? We were talking earlier about the loneliness of being a parent, you know, being a new parent, giving birth during a pandemic where you might be going out normally, BC, before COVID, to, you know, mummy meetups or baby massage. And that's where you meet your people a lot of the time. And at the minute, those options are really limited. Where does online come in, do you think?
Well, I think it has a really big role to play because it gives women an opportunity to connect with each other through something that's a very unique experience. I mean, I think going through especially a protracted infertility experience can feel so lonely and so isolating when your friends seem to get pregnant so easily and your sister had her third baby without even trying. And all of these stories that you hear, this kind of group allows women to connect with each other in that place of, you know, of fear and uncertainty, and having someone who really understands what that's like and can share their experience is such a valuable part of it. And it just helps you feel so much less alone, you know, pandemic or not. I mean, it's an isolating experience before COVID. So especially now, it's been, you know, we've done some online Zoom support calls, and they've been really well attended because people are really looking for connection, and I'm really happy to be able to provide some.
At which stage, we've had a question saying, would you advise getting in contact with you? So if someone is struggling to get pregnant? Is it a case of, you know, it's been 6 months, or we're thinking about IVF, it's been a year? When is it worth reaching out to actually kind of avail of your expertise?
Sure. I mean, I would welcome anyone to reach out whenever they were starting to think about having a baby, because, you know, like I said, there are things that we could discuss before you would even need to go see a doctor. You know, I happily have complimentary 20-minute consultations with anybody, and we can kind of chat basically about sort of where they are and what's happening. And then if you wanted to do a sort of wider package of, you know, lifestyle and diet changes or things to do to increase egg quality, there are all kinds of things that we can talk about way before you would ever need to go see a doctor. And then if you're already at the stage where you're looking at doctors, you know, there are things we can do there. My goal is to just help you from wherever you are to wherever you're trying to go.
So you just want to get as many women as pregnant as possible.
That's my goal. Yeah.
Not personally, we should clarify.
No.
But I think the really interesting point here is kind of taking out the friction points, and we know how expensive IVF is. You know, we really do know. So if you can minimize perhaps whether it's number of rounds, or maybe going to a clinic where you don't gel with the doctor or their philosophy isn't going to match yours, it kind of, it hopefully could expedite things. It hopefully can help people find the experts that are going to be aligned with their values and with their bodies and their background. And I think it sounds fantastic. Yeah. What's the best way of getting in touch with you, Cassie?
Well, there is our Facebook group, which is IVF Support UAE on Facebook. And then our website is IVFSupportUAE.com. There is a link there for the fertility doula services with a little bit more information about what I can do. And there's a contact button there as well.
Cassie Dizino, thank you so, so much. Really appreciate it. And you can head along. It is, of course, a closed group, IVF Support UAE, to answer any questions. Sammy's been in touch, dad of three great boys, saying, I'd like to share the positives. We attended Bourne Hall in Dubai, one of the best. Dr. Diana getting a shout out. So it's tough, it's costly, it's demanding and emotional, but wow, what a life changer it has been for all of us. Three great boys. Sammy's not like a great dad.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking IVF this afternoon, live on the line now is Ali Clifton, sharing her story about IVF. Ali, thank you so much for being with us on Dubai Eye this afternoon. Can you talk us through your, I really hate the word journey,
but your, hi, Helen.
Hi, yeah. Your IVF journey. How did it start?
Honestly, it was something that completely came out of the blue. Although I got married late in life. I was 41, but I was generally healthy, so I really didn't think it would be a problem. The women in my family have generally been very fertile, even well into their late 40s. So again, I didn't have any indication that I'd be experiencing any issues. But after a while, it became clear that we weren't conceiving naturally. So we went to see a doctor, and we had got a diagnosis of secondary infertility and male factor issues. And the final word was that there's a less than 5% chance of us having children. So, and then on top of that, another diagnosis of diminished ovarian reserve. So it's, you get a crash course in IVF right out the gate, and that can be super intimidating. And that's where it started for us. We ended up doing 6 cycles in total of IVF from 2018 to the end of 2019. There was several breaks in between each cycle while I got a handle on everything that was happening and trying to learn and trying to catch up. By the third cycle, I was experiencing huge anxiety, verging on depression. There were mornings where I would call my sister just wanting to meet up so that I could let it vent and let out. And, you know, there were a couple of times where I was crying in Starbucks. It happens. It happens to, it's just the way it is sometimes. You have to go. Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, some of the news you were getting from doctors was, well, not very encouraging, and certainly.
No.
So how did you find the support group, find Cassie, and how did it change things, Ali?
Well, one morning, you know, you don't know the difference between how to inject yourself, and then the next morning you're being taught the difference between an intramuscular injection or a subcutaneous injection, and, you know, you're confused. You don't know how to do it. And YouTube videos, they're out there, sure, but then I heard from my GP when I was telling her that I was going through IVF. She said there's this lovely lady called Cassie. She has an IVF support group. You might want to check it out. Here's her number. And this is at the point where I just finished a third cycle with very not encouraging results. So I ended up calling her the very next day. And at that point, as you can imagine, the mental fortitude that a person tries to bring to this kind of difficulty, this kind of challenge, it's hard to continue. Especially after you've been told that your last three cycles were a bust, basically. So I ended up sitting with Cassie, and there was a turnaround for me personally in terms of how I dealt with my next attempts in IVF. She'd given me advice that basically boiled down to choose a clinic or a doctor that suits your lifestyle. And when she said that, it dawned on me that IVF had taken over all of my life, every aspect. And it does. It genuinely does. Nobody gives you a warning when you're going into that, to the clinic for that first visit. Nobody tells you that this is what's happening. This is what's going to happen. This is how much you're going to have to read or learn about various terminology or definitions or what's going on with your body. Or I'm lucky in that I have family here and that I have an amazing husband. But still, even in those circumstances, by the time you get to your fourth cycle or your fifth cycle and you've experienced failure after failure, having someone come in and kind of outline to you a roadmap for how to be able to get through this was invaluable. It truly was. We've talked through the clinic options out there. We talked through the profiles of what doctors were there. And mind you, this was all from her without any kind of like expectation in return. And we talked about evaluating protocols. And I think if I had more knowledge about how to evaluate my protocols and the ones that I was going through, I probably would have saved myself about three cycles, and they do cost a lot. The average cycle is about 30,000 dirhams here. So if you're going in and you've got this kind of like diagnosis, or like somebody's giving you a statistic of these are the chances of your success, having someone hold your hand while you're going through it in terms of emotional support is invaluable. Again, there's a gap out there. The clinics, I mean, they do their best, but doctors have several patients. So they come in, they give you what they can, and then they need to move on to the next person.
And they haven't been through it themselves. You know, there's so much to be said for having been there in, you know, celebrating little wins, but also understanding the devastation when things just don't happen. And then there to be celebrating the biggest win, which is Millie. So your little girl is 6 months old now. How's life as a new mum?
6 months tomorrow. It's amazing. It's everything that I expected and more. She's lovely. She's wonderful. I honestly pray that any woman out there going through this kind of challenge walks away with a baby in the end.
Oh, I'm so, so thrilled for you. I'm thrilled that you've
thank you
that you found Cassie at some point during that time, and that you were able to rally, you know, to get the help that you needed, and to get there and have a beautiful baby. And I have to say, 6 months is my favorite age because they're responsive, they smile, they're not mobile yet. It's amazing. Well, enjoy every single moment, Ali. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. A number of messages saying, which group? It is IVF Support UAE. It is a closed group for understandable reasons, but answer a few questions and those resources are there.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And really sad that we're having to discuss this issue. There are some parents who are still leaving their children in their cars. And after reported deaths in recent years, it is still happening. Just last week, a four-year-old girl died of suffocation in Dubai after getting stuck in a vehicle for hours. Reports say Dubai police said 53 children were left alone in their vehicles in 2020 alone. And this year, February, just last month, there were 12. joined on the line now by Mara Masani, who's the founder of Child Safe. She's an advisor, an advocate and a campaigner in international child's rights and also works with local authorities. Mariam, how are you? It's so lovely to be joined by you today.
Hi, Helen. Thank you. I hope you're well. Thanks
I
for
am
having
really
me.
Well, if a bit shocked, to be honest, by the yeah. fact that we're still having to talk about this. This recent instance, tell us more about it. What were the circumstances that led to this little girl being left in that car?
Yeah, it's devastating. I mean, we talked about this, I think, 2 years ago. There was a different accident. And unfortunately, this tragedy can happen to any family. You know, sometimes when we ask the question, or how can we prevent this from happening? And I talk to a lot of parents and they say to me, I don't think I will ever do that. You know, but it's not about questioning parents about how they deal with their children. And I'm sure no one does this intentionally.
No,
you know, it's always an accident, a tragedy that happens. But there are measures that we can take to prevent it from happening. And yeah, and this is very sad that we are coming back to this topic because it's heartbreaking. I mean, I can't tell you how heartbreaking it is because you have your own kids and you know how it feels when anything happens to your own child. So yes, it's very, very sad to hear about that. But one of the things that I was trying to get one of the mothers who went through this experience, and luckily the child is okay. 2 years ago, this happened. She left the child in the car. She went out shopping, but then came back. The child fainted, and they had to take him to the hospital. But the thing is, she's still, after 2 years, traumatized mm-hmm. that she couldn't share her story. And I totally understand this, Helen, because it's something that it stays with you, you know. So how can we prevent it from happening? How can we do more awareness and campaigns around this topic?
I think that is so, so valuable, to be honest, because, you know, the worst happening as a parent, especially if you feel like it was your fault, you know, this child, yeah. you know, dies as a result of a decision you made, or even something that was, you know, a pure accident, you know, to have to live with that would be absolute torture. So what kind of things can we put in place to make sure that this situation doesn't arise? What can we as parents be doing?
So, I mean, in terms of awareness and campaigning around this topic as a parent, there are a few tips that I can share with you. So first of all, I mean, I think we mentioned this even 2 years ago when we discussed it. Place something in the back seat that you have to take with you when you come out of the car. You know, this is for those who really forget that they're having a busy day, or maybe dropping children was never their part of their role. Or maybe they're covering for the babysitter, or they're covering for the other parents or other partner in the parenting responsibilities. So leave something in the backseat that you have, like your wallet, maybe your keys, your phone, and then you know you have to look back and you will see your child that it's still there. You know, you're not going to leave them in the car. So that's one tip for those who are having a busy day or it's out of their routine to even drop their kids to the daycare or anywhere that they're going. The other thing is to create a check-in system, you know, similar to what we talked about the bus drivers for the schools, because this happened again with the bus drivers here in school, leaving the children behind while they are sleeping. So if you create a checklist and this becomes part of your routine in making sure, okay, I'm checking the back seat, I'm checking everything, nobody's here and I'm not leaving anyone behind, that becomes part of your habits. I mean, I don't know if you have any habits yourself when you are dropping your kids or going with your kids anywhere, Helen.
Mariam, I am no. I'm the one who always forgets to, you know, put her pass on at school. No, but there are certain things that, and I really like that, just super practical advice, because we know how exhausted parents are. We know that we go yeah. into automatic pilot mode for much of the day and, you know, trying to get through the mornings. So if there are some practical steps that we can take that we just know we're going to look behind and make sure everybody's safe. Reva saying, I've seen this outside my son's school. Parents leaving their younger kids in the car as they walk their older children into the classroom. The engine is running, but anything can happen. It's a busy parking lot, but I don't feel I have the right to approach them and tell them that it's wrong. And saying, we were just talking about unsolicited parenting advice from other people. We don't want to sound intrusive, but this is a safety issue. What can you do in this scenario? What would you advise?
I mean, this goes back to what we discussed about the buckling children and the car seats. You know, if they are going to speak up, if they see a parent not doing it, of course we have to. We have to always speak up. You know, there's, even if they don't see it as something helpful at that time, but you can be helping, preventing something from happening. Mm-hmm. So I can understand how difficult it could be to interfere with a parenting style or just to even approach a parent to say, I think you shouldn't be doing that. But I would say everyone has a responsibility to safeguard children. And we need to make sure we speak up. We need to make sure that we share and raise awareness among our community with the parents that we know or even we don't know, because this can safeguard a child, you know, can save a life. And also, like, if you have a child in the car and you need to drop your other child, you never know how long it's going to take for you to come back. Yeah. You know, you might meet a friend on the way, you start talking and chatting and you forget.
You could fall and break your leg. You just don't know.
Or have an accident on the way crossing back yourself. What would it happen to your child? So never assume that your child will be safe unattended by an adult. Always make sure your child is with someone in the car as an adult, or take the child with you, or just have a different arrangement. I don't think it's good to justify that I have to just run for 2 minutes and come back, because the risk is high. The risk is high.
I really like this from Troy, saying, I can see a time where artificial intelligence comes in when the vehicle queries leaving it in the car saying, you know, would you like to take Phoebe with you, Helen? Very good application of science. I like that. Maren, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. If anyone wants to check out some of the resources you have across all aspects of child protection, work with you as well, I know you do a lot of work with Dubai Police. What's the best way of contacting you?
They can visit our website at www.childsafeme.com or our Instagram page at childsafeme. And we will be very happy to support and answer any questions related to child protection and child safeguard.
Brilliant. Maren Rissani there. Please, people, just do everything you can in your power to stay safe and keep those others safe. We don't want your child to become a statistic that we're talking about on the show this afternoon.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Don't we all know it, but being a new parent is tough enough. But when you have people telling you how to parent, it can become 100 times tougher. I'm not talking about reaching out to Facebook forums or messaging your mum or your best friend asking specifically for advice, but the unsolicited advice that can come from strangers, from family. It has to be said. This is exactly what a recent international study by Kantar, commissioned by Nestle, says. They asked 8,000 mums and dads of babies up to a year old in 16 countries, and 60% of respondents said that they felt everyone around them had a view on how to raise their children, be it in-laws, relatives, friends, and yes, even strangers. What do you feel about that number? Have you ever experienced it? Delighted to be joined on the line now by Dr. Sarah Rasmi. She's a licensed psychologist, the founder of Thrive Wellbeing Centre. Now, Dr. Sarah, this has happened to us all frequently, to be honest. I've had people come up to me saying that I should put socks on my baby. I've had people commenting on giving my baby formula. I've had people telling me what buggy I should buy without me asking them. How common is this? I don't know any parent that hasn't been told that they're doing it all wrong or hasn't been given solicited advice. Have you had experience of this?
Yes, absolutely. I've been on the receiving end, and I think all of us have been on the receiving end. I think one thing we can all agree on is that we don't really like it. At the same time, we've probably also doled out, maybe unknowingly, unsolicited advice as well. So it's a little bit tricky, and it puts us in a bit of a pickle when we're on the receiving end of it, because really what ends up happening is there's a part of us that rejects what the person is saying because we want to exercise our freedom and our autonomy, some pretty basic human needs. But at the same time, we know that if we reject what they're saying, we're at the risk of not pleasing them and maybe experiencing displeasure and rejection. Mm-hmm. So those two things can be at odds, and that can be quite unsettling.
What I would say is that, I really hope my husband's not listening, when I get advice from my mother-in-law, a lot depends on how resilient I'm feeling in that moment. If I am feeling rested and feeling positive and someone, be it a stranger or a family I'm married into, drops a clanger or says something that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily like, if I'm feeling happy, if I'm feeling fine, it's water for duck's back. If I'm a new parent and I am exhausted and I'm feeling insecure in my parenting, I don't feel like I know what I'm doing, things can really cut deep. It can really kind of shake your confidence and make you feel massively insecure. How do you feel it can affect parents in possibly the worst way sometimes?
Well, like with anything, I think timing is absolutely key, and also the way that we message things is really important. Mm-hmm. So what you're describing is what we know is unhelpful in communication. So approaching somebody with something when they are hungry, angry, upset, lonely,
tired.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's just not going to go very well. So when that happens, it can be really problematic. And then also we need to, if we're approaching someone, I think what can be helpful is asking before we give out the advice if the person is ready or willing to hear it, because maybe they are open to getting feedback and learning from other people's experience, but just because you are doesn't mean you are all of the time. So normalizing asking permission for that, and then for us on the receiving end of it, feeling comfortable saying something along the lines of, I'm really interested to hear what you have to say. It's not the best time. Let's chat about this, you know, tomorrow or next week or whatever.
So how do you ask permission then? Okay. You know, I can't even think of a situation where I actually would be open to this. But if someone does feel like they've got something that is truly valuable, helpful, and not at all insulting to add to somebody's life when it comes to raising their children, how do you broach that?
So it's tricky because I said at the beginning that everybody has given out unsolicited advice. However, there are some people that are more repeat offenders than others. And a lot of times when we look at what their characteristics are, people who give out a lot of unsolicited advice tend to be a little bit more rigid. They are trying to get some control and order. A lot of times they're used to being the quote-unquote fixers or problem solvers. That's a role that they've had maybe even in childhood. And so it's a pattern that is quite cemented. But what I mean when I say permission is when you are having a conversation with someone and suddenly an amazing idea or solution to their problem dawns on you, rather than immediately sharing it, saying something along the lines of, you've been telling me about your experience with this. What do you need from me right now? Do you need me to listen? Or would you like me to help you try and find a solution? And in that case, if the person says, look, I just really want to vent, I need to get it off my chest, you keep it to yourself. But if the person says, I'm open to getting feedback, then they're going to be more receptive to it. And it's going to be more satisfying to you because you're going to see that the person is genuinely interested and they're probably more likely to take it up.
I would just like to say that I am such a hypocrite because I'm there kind of going, oh, the stranger said this to me and it really upset me. But then I have also been that person. And here, I think this could be perhaps where there is a bit of a boundary, where I have pulled up at traffic lights and said, have you thought about getting a car seat for your baby? That's a safety thing. Am I absolved of all guilt? Or should I just keep that to myself?
You know, one of the main things that I've studied throughout my academic career is conflict. And one of the things that I think is important is that we let people have freedom when it comes to making personal decisions. Oh. There's a little less latitude, though, when it comes to health and safety. And this qualifies as a health and safety issue. So I think it's less offensive and problematic for you to share that sort of feedback than maybe something else, like you really need to get the stroller, something that would very much be preference rather than health and safety.
Lots of messages coming in this, unsurprisingly. Carly saying a lot of this is cultural. I've been told off in the supermarket for buying formula by a woman who told me that breast was best. I know she meant well, but it was really upsetting. Carly, I have been in that situation and I cried. So I'm with you. And you're like, I would, that would have been great. However, that's not the situation and you know nothing about my life, so walk away, woman. No name on this one saying, I made the decision to go back to teaching when my daughter was 2 months old. Constantly get remarks from people, usually ones who don't have children. Oh, I won't work when I have children, and it's super annoying. Perhaps I'm too sensitive. Maybe it's niggling me as it triggers something that makes me feel like I'm a bad mum who leaves her daughter. You are not a bad mum. Let's just say that straight out. And I think things like that often... it's more a comment on the people that's saying it than any kind of comment in you. And I've had that about being a working mum as well. So don't let their insecurities shake your decision at all. And I think that's such an interesting angle, actually. Whenever I've asked for advice, you always want people to make the same decision as you did. So using the stroller example, if someone says in a Facebook group, oh, you know, I'm looking to get a stroller, which one? You really want someone to take your advice because then it validates the decision that you made. It made you feel like you made the right thing. And it all comes back to we're all just pretty insecure. We were all bumbling along, trying to do our best. And we've had many messages on this. The advice that we may get from strangers, from relatives, from friends that we just don't want and we certainly didn't ask for. Here's Nisha, a mum of two boys.
Many people don't stop to think for a minute of what the parent is going through, what the parent has gone through, the stresses, the sacrifices we make. And speaking from one that two boys have again on growth hormone, the amount of change I've had to do personally in my life, and simple things like traveling is not that easy, but yet everybody will give their comments on how we need to travel, where we should go, how I should carry it, how I should, you know, give them a break from it. And it's really, really tiring.
It is indeed. I wanted to ask you, you know, there's so much pressure on new mums and dads. So from the front point of view of that nosy neighbour, relative or friend, why do people feel the need to tell parents what to do, Dr. Sarah?
A lot of times it's about connection. It's about seeing that you're going through something and it's something that I've gone through, and it's a way for the two of us to start connecting with one another. As you said before, it can be validating for the decisions that we've made. So there can be a lot of different motivations in addition to what I was sharing previously about some personality traits being more likely to give consistent, unsolicited feedback than others.
I think it can get very complicated because it's one thing to smile politely and say thank you to someone in the supermarket or, you know, in a mall or even online. I get this on my Instagram quite a lot, people being like, hi, just thought you might like to hear. No, I'm fine, thank you. But what if it's family? What if it's an in-law that you're living with or someone that you're on Zoom with, someone that's visiting? How can you create boundaries within the family to say that, do you know what, if I need you, I will come to you and thank you very much in the meantime, but back off.
Yeah, it's very, very tricky because when it's family, we are embedded within a lot of different relationships. It's not just dyadic. We also have to think of how it's going to impact the broader family system. At the same time, one of the things we need to be aware of is we can never change another person. The most that we can do is influence their behavior. And one of the best ways for us to be able to influence that behavior is to implement some boundaries using assertive communication strategies. A lot of times people don't realize their objective or their aim is to be helpful, to disseminate information that they think is valuable, or they're so anxious about what's going on in your life and they're trying to find a way to soothe themselves through giving you that bit of feedback. So giving them the benefit of doubt where appropriate, and then taking a moment to use a very clear and direct I statement to describe how what they're doing is making you feel. So once people recognize the emotional impact of their behavior, they're more likely to be receptive to what it is that you're saying, and then to just sort of consistently do that until hopefully it at least subsides if it doesn't disappear entirely.
What do you mean by an I statement? Because in my mind, I'm like, I don't want to hear this. Is that what you mean?
with an I statement, I mean something along the lines of, I'm feeling overwhelmed right now, and I really would prefer that we had this discussion later, or I would prefer that you respected my choices, that sort of a thing.
Nice. Okay, I'm all over it. So how do you clap back? This is what our news editor Natasha Thomas says she's going to do.
I know there are mothers out there who've had to deal with situations like that. I certainly haven't. But, you know, if a random stranger were to tell me how to raise my kids, I would just tell them to mind their own business.
Straight to the point. Mind your own business. Dr. Sarah, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I feel like, oh, it's a minefield. It is a minefield. And I would just like to take a moment to kind of acknowledge some of the challenges that new parents who have given birth, you know, during the pandemic are facing right now. You know, it can be a really, really lonely time when you've just had a baby, and whether that is, you know, struggling during the day or those night feeds where you feel like the only person on the planet awake is you. And for many, I know those meetups were an absolute lifeline on the social side as well. And those, unfortunately, can't happen right now. Would you have any advice for any new mums and dads who might be struggling with some kind of COVID-specific challenges of having a baby at the moment?
I think the really important thing is to remember that even though you probably feel quite alone, you are not alone. It is really tough. And no matter what we read and how we prepare ourselves, we can never be fully prepared for the challenges of being a parent in general, let alone all of the complications that come with the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. So knowing that, and knowing that the experience is relatively normal without minimizing how difficult and challenging it may be, trying to find people who are going through the same thing at the same time, sharing experiences, trusting your gut. And I think a lot of times we become overwhelmed by all of, not just the opinions, but all of the information out there. And we don't trust what our instinct is telling us. And our instinct is usually quite good. And making sure that we can take care of ourselves as much as we can. And sometimes that might be putting boundaries in our interpersonal relationships. Other times that might be making sure that we're taking care of our physical health, making sure that we're staying social, nurturing our professional growth or hobbies, spirituality, those sorts of things. So that would be my advice. And I don't want to say that it gets better because it sounds very, very cliche and they've probably heard it a million and 10 times, but it does in a lot of ways. And hopefully now we're all seeing a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, and we will be able to resume some of those very, very important community support networks that we have enjoyed in the past.
I hope so. Dr. Sarah Rasmi, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Sarah, licensed psychologist there at Thrive Wellbeing Centre.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I'm Helen Farmer with you until 5 o'clock this afternoon. And today we're discussing a bit of time management problems, to be honest. We're asking, is your child distracted in school, whether they're virtual learning or they are in the classroom? Are they having a hard time managing their time with schoolwork, big projects, exams, extracurricular and other responsibilities? Getting some tips now from Sarah Sakari, the Associate Head of Lower School at Dwight School, Dubai, addressing some issues that many children and adults, I should say, as well, especially have encountered during the pandemic. And they all revolve around time management. Sarah, thank you for joining us. I am very much going to be listening back to this on the podcast with my notebook in hand, because I'm not known for my time management either, which worries me for the sake of my children, because these skills can often be learned at home. Do you tend to take after your parents when it comes to managing these things?
Hi, Helen. Yes, I mean, time management is tricky for lots of us, and it does sometimes pass on to kids at home, but sometimes it doesn't. So don't worry about it. I think your kids still have a chance.
Okay, good.
I do think some of this is learned at home, but I also think that nowadays, with us identifying what's important when it comes to time management and what kids need to do, and starting at an early age, there's always something that we can do to show the kids the different strategies that they can use when we identify time management as a skill that we can learn and not just a behavior that we have.
You also teach it. How is it embedded in the curriculum?
So So it is part of our self-management skills. In the IB, we have the five ATL skills, and self-management is one of these. And time management falls underneath self-management skills. So for us, it is a skill that we choose sometimes to embed into the unit. And it's often where we get the kids to take responsibility for their time and to lead their own projects, to time themselves and to plan, working with timelines, schedules and checklists.
You do have some top five time management tips for students, although I think we could probably all learn a few things from this. What is your number one, Sarah?
So number one is to definitely plan and prioritize. That's extremely important. To set a plan, to have a plan, and to prioritize what comes first. What do I need to do first? How do I finish that? How do I move on? How do I leave things that aren't necessarily that important at this stage and just focus on what I really need to get done?
I mean, thinking back to my A-levels, which quite a few years ago, let's say 10, but actually 20, I was queen of the revision schedule. I was there with the highlighters. I was making my plans to procrastinate actually having to do it. My room had never been so tidy. My nails had never been so well painted. But can I ask you for any tips around procrastination, especially for kids? And I have to say, when we were doing distance learning, anything on the iPad felt really problematic because all they wanted to do was watch YouTube and not do any work. Any tips from a teacher?
So I think the tip I can give is what we really value is reflection and reassessment. So what we need to do is the timeline needs to be based on the student age, not to give kids a timeline that goes for days and days without checking on them. Or hours and hours. Of course, it depends on the age group. Let us stop, reflect. What have you done so far? If it's not working, why is it not working? And us reflecting and reassessing the situation. Because if it's not working because I'm doing other things that are not a priority, then I need to stop and focus. If it's not working because the task is too hard, because I can't do it on the iPad, I'm getting distracted. It depends on what it is. And I do agree with you, during distance learning last year, we figured that once the kids were not within our eyesight, it was really hard to see what they're doing. And that's why we started factoring this reflection and reassessment time, where we would stop and think and reflect, how far have you gone? What is working and what's not? We call it the WWW, what went well, and even better if. If you give students, kids, adults, a timeline that's way too long, then probably what happens is it's too late then to manage the damage, in a sense. So it would help to put these reflection points where we can stop and think and fix the problem.
COVID has thrown routines and schedules completely out of the window. And I know when children perhaps get a little bit older, there's more structure, there's more live Zooms. But for others where you're effectively given a list of tasks, and that might mean in really little ones, you know, watching a video on YouTube and then recording a video for your teacher. You know, nothing is certain. And even if you plan something, sometimes you have to quarantine or the rules change, you know, you just have to roll with it. What are some of the things, even if it comes down to equipment or apps, any tips and tricks that you think all parents should have kind of in their arsenal to help children with their time management when it comes to studying and to homework as well?
I think in general, just thinking about time management, and it's something that many of us don't know, is that kids really do not have a concept of time. So this is something that we really need to keep in mind.
So
if you say to a child, you have 20 minutes to finish this, they have no idea what 20 minutes is. It's really very difficult for a child to have a proper concept of time. When we teach time, we try to let them have activities that they do. What can you do in a minute? What can you do in a second? And the first time you introduce this concept, it's hilarious because what the kids say is so not realistic. So it's extremely important for us adults to know that when we know what 5 minutes is, the kids do not. So something that would really, really help is in class, we use lots of stand timers because this is a visual that the kids can see. They can see when we say you have 5 minutes, they can see that now I have half of the 5 minutes. We use digital timers. I think using timers is extremely important because it gives the kids, we've had this discussion over brushing teeth for ages, and we only succeeded when we actually got timers for brushing teeth. I think it's just extremely important for parents to know. Kids do not know what it means when you tell them 10 minutes, and when you get upset because they're not ready in 10 minutes, they probably didn't know what 10 minutes is.
It's so true.
So just show them time, yeah.
Mine, if I say, okay, you know, 5 minute warning, iPad's going off in 1 minute now, and then they'll count down, they'll go, stop counting, because they know. this is also the children where anything that happened in the past, whether it was an hour ago or literally 5 years ago, everything's yesterday. Time is completely elastic to them. So telling them they've got 20 minutes left to do something, totally useless. So sans timer, I like that a lot. And I noticed myself, Sarah, that my attention span over the last year has become completely decimated. What are you guys as teachers seeing when it comes to children's attention span during the pandemic?
Yes, I agree. It's because the things are looking very different these days, and every activity or engagement that used to be extremely natural and normal is now not. And we have to put a lot of thought into all interactions. So it is exhausting, to be honest. What we are trying to do is giving those kids the movement breaks because they do need them, even if it's in the classroom, that they move and play a quick game, that they do something where they're not needing to get closer to each other or be in contact, which would have been extremely natural in previous times because mostly engagements and activities involve movement and them doing things around the classroom. Now that this is not very possible and they have to stay in the same place for most of the time, we are kind of creating those natural movement breaks where they can stand and dance for a little bit or do something. That's, of course, part of what we've planned for the day, and it will have a purpose as part of the lesson. But just making sure that those kids aren't really sitting in front of a screen or sitting at their desks for a long period of time, because they do need to move. They do need those breaks for them to be able to focus on the task at hand.
Speaking of screens, how do you feel like we as parents, and of course teaching community as well, can use technology effectively and productively? Because as we know, there's a lot of screen-based learning going on. It's certainly not going anywhere. But how can we perhaps use technology to our advantage?
So what we are trying to do these days is mostly on top of using technology to connect, because not all of us are in the same place at this stage anymore, and we don't see it changing for the coming future at least, is seeing how is it that we can use technology to make sure that the kids are being productive and they're not just doing the same thing that they can do without technology. So if we're using technology to actually work together in groups, because sitting and working together in groups is not really that possible these days, then we're trying to do that. We're trying to use it more to connect than to replace other tools, because we would rather get kids off screens when we can. Mm-hmm. But if it is to save them and to make sure that they're safe and not sitting at close distance, but still being able to share their ideas and their thoughts, that is really great, because that's a huge part of the learning. And we don't want the kids to be just in their own bubble working on their own, but we also don't want them to be sitting together using the same resources and being so close to each other. So we found technology to be really helpful when it comes to connection, and that's mostly how we're using it, as opposed to the way it used to replace how you present your work. We're trying to now balance that with actually physically presenting things for them to be off the screen for a bit.
Before I let you get back to your no doubt busy day, a question from Brendan saying, how can we get our children to do something that they absolutely do not want to do?
That's a hard one.
If we had the answer to that, I'd be writing my parenting book. No, but I think that point is, and we had this a lot with distance learning. And it, in some ways, it was really useful as a parent to see some of the subjects or even aspects of a subject that our children really enjoyed, but also some that they, you know, really struggled with or just simply didn't like. And for my daughter, loves reading, loves maths, loves sport, but writing really struggles with. And as a result, she doesn't want to do it. And I will sit there watching her writing a word for what feels like 6 weeks, and I end up getting frustrated. She picks up on that. And then, of course, it creates this cycle of, like, I just don't want to do it. And she gets down from the desk and, you know, the iPad is, you know, it's just a problem. So what advice would you give, apart from staying calm, which I'd love to do, for encouraging our children to perhaps get the stuff done that they might not really enjoy?
So I think we all know that there are things we all don't enjoy doing. And I think that's a lesson that's good for kids to learn. I think the key is one in the balance. So we need to make sure that we are balancing the schedule of the kids. So if they do something that they don't really enjoy, then maybe we get to kind of balance it with something that they do enjoy doing afterwards, even if that's related to school as well. We do need to play on that balance and on explaining to kids that it's not always what we want to do, and that doing what we have to do sometimes gives you a good feeling. What we try to focus on also being in an Ivy school is the learner profile and making sure that kids see, get the pleasure of doing things through that intrinsic motivation, mm-hmm. wanting to be communicators or wanting to be risk takers or wanting to be open-minded and doing something that they don't really want to do. So we do celebrate the kids when we know that this has not been a task they wanted to do, and we get them to feel that they have actually done something and developed something in them, not that they've just done it for someone else.
Yes.
And what we also try to do is try to kind of have that balance between what they like to do and what they don't like to do. If they hate writing, and if it's possible to give them a topic to write about that they really, really love, if they love football and they hate writing, maybe we want to start getting them to write about football. And then maybe that makes it a little bit easier, and then we can get some balance there.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. Sarah Stardy there from Dwight School, Dubai.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Wonderful to be joined on the line now by the Secretary General of Diamond 2021 Dubai International School. It's Naya Sahe, and we're discussing the perhaps impending pandemic of unemployment. We've seen so many people, young and old, really looking to try and address what could be one of the world's biggest problems. But at this school, there's an academic activity called the Model United Nations. These students are aspiring to be the Secretary General of the UN. So, Sneha, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your ideas today on what is truly one of the toughest problems that we are yet to solve, that of unemployment, and something that's going to be affecting you and your peers. Would you mind just starting by explaining what is the Model United Nations?
So Model United Nations is kind of just a simulation of the actual United Nations, and it's kind of a phenomenon that we see all around Dubai and all around the world. It's kind of a high school thing and also a college thing. And how it works is we have delegates, so our participants who come in and they represent different countries. They create resolutions, which are basically solutions to all of the world problems that we provide them with. They create these resolutions and they debate on them, and they try to come up with ways that they can solve kind of current world crises.
One of the issues you're looking to address is that scale of the unemployment crisis. And I'd love to get your insight, if you wouldn't mind, on what you believe is, you know, has kind of caused it, what's happening, and really which sections of society are suffering the most.
Well, unemployment in general, it was obviously an issue before the pandemic as well. It's just been kind of amplified to such an extent because of the new government regulations that governments have put in all over the world to help stop the spread of the disease. There was kind of a lack of demand.
What worries us, I think, is how quickly people are having to adjust and, as you correctly state, downsize. And pre-pandemic, BC, before COVID, what were your plans in terms of further education and even the type of job you were looking to go into?
Well, funnily enough, I actually wanted to go into medical school, and I still do. Hmm. So, for me personally, the pandemic wouldn't have really impacted my employment. But, I mean, there's always kind of a need, a demand for doctors. But there's so many other people, for example, people that wanted to go into business, people that wanted to go into finance that are struggling now even to find placements and internships to help them with their application.
Can I ask you about some of the solutions that have been proposed at Diamond 2021? You know, what are some of the things that are being brought forward?
We had a bunch of solutions that were proposed, like increasing your funding on healthcare and pharmaceuticals to try and diminish the pandemic as much as we can. One particularly interesting solution I saw was lowering the minimum wage, or lowering the kind of individual base pay that people have in different countries. So that minimum wage varies from country to country, but by making it lower, perhaps firms and governments will be able to employ more people. Reducing taxes would also allow for firms to stay afloat a little bit, or maybe like allowing firms to maybe not pay certain taxes for certain periods of time would allow them to stay afloat. It would cut down on their expenses.
Something we've discussed on the show recently, when I interviewed a robot, which one of the stranger moments of my career, was about digitization, about AI and potential for job losses, and obviously potential for job opportunities as well in some ways. Where do you feel like there's opportunity there for businesses to adapt?
Well, I think our generation is kind of really well aware of the incoming AI storm that we're about to be faced with. And in that sense, we are also kind of being prepared by our schools and by our education system to just know and keep in the back of our minds that AI, it's not necessarily there to replace jobs. You know, it's more of a something that we use to aid us, at least at this point in our lives. It's something that we use to aid us. And while it can be used to replace certain jobs, I think all of us are then now looking towards working in industries where AI can't really replace a human, or rather just working in industries where you work at making the AI. A lot of people, like, there's a very high increasing trend towards working in computer science and computer engineering, so that you don't get replaced by the robots and you rather make the robots.
Sneha, can I ask you, do you feel like this is being taken seriously at a global level? What do we know about global bodies like the UN Foundation and other organizations doing?
There's only so much that firms or organizations like the UN can do. It is being taken seriously because I think, for example, if you look at climate change is not being taken necessarily as seriously as it should be, because it doesn't directly impact that many people. I mean, we see the impact in global warming and stuff like that, but we don't really necessarily feel a day-by-day impact of climate change. Whereas if you take unemployment, if you or your loved ones are being faced with unemployment, it's a lot easier to resonate and relate with the issue, which is why I think organizations are taking it more seriously. Governments are putting in efforts. If you look at the U.S., for example, they distributed stimulus checks towards the beginning of the pandemic to help out those that were faced by unemployment, because it's kind of a more relatable issue, which I mean, it's one of the, I wouldn't say good, but one of the slightly better aspects of the issue as compared to others.
Can I ask, if you could, you know, wave a magic wand and, you know, in a year's time things be very different, what do you think needs to be in place for you and your fellow students to graduate with more positivity on the job market?
I think 100% contingency planning was a problem in almost all small and large corporations. Obviously, we couldn't have seen this coming. We didn't know there was going to be a worldwide pandemic that would close down our businesses. But a lot of businesses didn't really have a plan, a crisis plan in action. Hopefully, this serves as a lesson for corporations to make sure that they're prepared for the worst, because you can never be too prepared. That's what I've learned. And I'm sure the United Nations and governments are coming up with similar, if not better ones. But just the implementation, they usually don't happen because we don't expect any problems to occur. And now that we have seen the worst situations of our lives, hopefully that'll inspire people to be more prepared for the future.
That was Sneha Sahe, Secretary General of the Model United Nations at Dubai International Academy.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are discussing the potential influx of an awful lot of people on the job market with not many jobs to go to as a result of COVID-19. But there is a group of young students who have got some ideas about some potential solutions, and certainly what people, both individuals and companies, could have in place to protect them further. Adam Norelli is joining us, Secretary General at Uptown International School, and discussing a pressing issue that has really worsened as a result of the pandemic: unemployment, one of the toughest problems we've yet to solve. And unfortunately, Adam and his peers could well be graduating into a world where jobs are scarce, or certainly very, very different to what we'd expected a number of years ago. Adam, I'd love to get some of the solutions that are being proposed amongst your group. What do you think would make some significant differences when it comes to creation of new jobs, or certainly increased adaptability of companies right now?
I guess one way we could tackle this is probably by adapting a very holistic approach to education. Now, companies, they are looking for individuals with a lot of skill sets, and it is our duty as people with access to these to education to ensure that everyone else has equality in access, and that we help everyone get the education they need to access these skills, to get these jobs, and essentially to return to a lively working environment.
Adam, what are your hopes in terms of further education and job role as well?
I graduate next year and I'm looking to study abroad, but it's tough knowing that there aren't as many jobs available. Like, as a kid, I was often fascinated with the airline industry, and all of a sudden COVID has caused the airline industry to take a massive dive. It creates a little bit of fear in our minds that there might not be a job for us when we graduate.
Can I ask what advice you would give to anyone who might be in that age bracket, you know, 16 to 18, thinking about further education, maybe having to make adjustments on the kind of job that they had dreamt of that's no longer possible? What would you say is the best way of moving forward as a young person in this pandemic situation?
We're often dreamers, right? We like to think big, and we often get very tunnel visioned on this one goal. But ever since COVID began, it's struck me that we often need to actually widen our scope a little bit. We need to make sure that we're balanced and we're able to apply them in different aspects. Now, it's important that we also increase our skills in technology, because technology will become a big part of our lives, and it will continue to become an even bigger part. I mean, COVID has been a wake-up call that one day the fields we dreamt of may just be rendered obsolete. As I said, it's important that we ensure that we're not so streamlined on one particular field, and we're able to adapt as we go along.
Couldn't agree more. That's Adam Nerolli, the Secretary General of the Model United Nations at Uptown International School.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Don't forget, you can tune into Dubai Eye 103.8 and hear us live between 2 and 5 every single weekday. Your chance to get answers from the experts, share your stories, and of course win some brilliant prizes too. Don't forget, please download, rate and subscribe. 5 stars, I'll accept 4, so it helps other people find the podcast and you'll get it immediately to your phone. Have a good one.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.